Okay, so tell me who you are and what you do at Microsoft.
Hi, Larry. My name is Wenming Yi, and I'm a technical evangelist for Windows Azure Evangelism team. And before I just recently joined the team, I've been working as the HPC evangelist for the last 3 years at Microsoft.
So we are in a very, very loud room. And this is a room that's kind of in the back of the building where the Channel 9 studio is.
Yep.
Tell us about this room and what you do in here.
Yeah, so this is our data center for Building 20, and we have a lot of machines here. So we have machines that I own and I use for HPC work, and there are other machines that we use for virtual labs. So if you come in this building and use one of our virtual labs and do your hands-on labs, we basically provide all the work in here. All the entire infrastructure is virtualized. We also have a large storage system that we have in here.
And for people who don't know, what is HPC?
So HPC stands for High Performance Computing, and it's probably some of the earliest forms of computers. It goes back to the Cray days or even before that. So what we do is we solve large, difficult problems, and sometimes people call them time and space complexity problems. What that means is that you have to use a lot of memory and CPU to compute that problem. And in most cases, it's systems that are owned by large companies as well as government agencies. So some of the supercomputers in the world, there's a top 500 list where you have the top 500 supercomputers in the world. So these are the machines that are considered top of the line for HPC. So essentially we try to do R&D and solve very large problems that can't fit on a single machine.
Tell us about the machines that we're looking at here.
So I have three machines here, and they are from about 2 years ago, and I've inherited them. So these machines are essentially the desk side Cray boxes, and they are capable of doing up to 128 gigabytes of RAM and also 64 processors in this box. So the idea is to have this sitting in your office, and this turns out that I used to have this particular machine that's sitting in this rack in my office. And Larry did complain about the noise that he heard when we actually had the computation going on.
So yeah, it was funny because this is how we met. I actually walked past an office and I heard the loudest noise that I'd ever heard coming out of a Microsoft office. And I poked my head in there and there was this Cray that was just going at it. So I wanted to find out, who owns the Cray here? And turns out it was one of your machines.
And I have three of them. Actually, there are four of them. One of them is still sitting in my office. So I kept one and moved the rest of them over here. What's interesting about these machines is that the earlier prototype, which is the one you actually saw, didn't have noise canceling on it. So it was really loud. It's essentially an airplane taking off. But on this little control panel here, I can actually go ahead and dial up and down the fan speed. So it doesn't have to be that loud when you're not using them. And also the interesting thing about these machines is that once you have noise cancellation, it's really not that bad. But the only challenge that I see for an ordinary person to have one of these is that you do need a 20 amp socket. That's actually standard in all Microsoft offices. So we could have one in my office, but it does heat up the room when you don't have individual controls in your room for the temperature.
It's nice in the winter because the offices do get cold. And it is, it's freezing in here. So
it is.
Yeah.
Look at the fan right behind you. It's blowing at you.
A little bit chilly.
Yeah, it's a little bit chilly. So we try to keep it at about 65 degrees in this data center.
So what types of things do you do with these machines?
So these machines have been used for customer engagements as well as demos that we use. So a lot of these machines actually have, the one in the bottom, they have, you know, 8 blades each.
Describe what a blade is.
So a blade is one of the smaller unit of, it's essentially a computer that you can slide out of the larger unit. So this larger unit fits about 8 blades that you can slide out.
So it's like a computer on
exactly.
a car.
It's a little container.
Yeah.
It's a little, you know, cargo container. We have two processors, and this model is a few years old. So we have 8 cores, meaning that we have 2 processors and a total of 8 cores. And we have 16 gigabytes of memory each on these units. So a total of 128 gigabytes of RAM.
Nice.
Plus that we have 64 cores that we can use to do a relatively large computational problem.
So one of the things that you did in our department is when Hurricane Irene was coming around, you sent us a weather forecast that turned out to be a little bit more accurate than what I saw on TV. Talk about that. How did you do that?
So the weather simulation we ran is using a piece of code called WRF, or WRF spelled, and it's called Weather Research and Forecast. It's a joint project from our friends from UNCAR and also NOAA. So these are all, you know, two of the government agencies that are responsible for climate changes research and also weather research and among other things, like ocean and atmosphere, basically. So these agencies developed this code over a period of, I would say, 20 or 30 years. And so we're simply using their code by porting them to Windows and for the very first time, and running them on these machines so that you don't need a very large supercomputer to be able to run these codes. And currently, they're running on this machine and also the one below. But we're actually moving that onto Azure so that we can share that simulation with anyone who wants to just simply type in a longitude, latitude of the city they're at, and also how many days they want to forecast out. So the simulation takes data from NOAA and UNCAR and runs a bunch of preprocessors, and then there's actually 11 steps in that. It becomes relatively complicated. And then what we do is we run the large finite element code called WRF on it, which will take you a few hours up to a few days, depending on how large the data set is. And then at the end, we post-process that and try to kind of make a movie out of it, or maybe just static images. So once we have that working on Azure, you would have that entire process hidden from you, and just about anyone would be able to go on and just run that themselves without having to have one of your supercomputer. It's one of the ways of democratizing science, or making awareness of these type of very sophisticated R&D software that's only available to universities and government agencies.
So tell us a little bit about the differences between Azure and these HPC machines.
Yeah, absolutely. So Azure is Microsoft's cloud compute offering. So currently, on some of the larger nodes, we can have up to 8 cores. So these can do some serious computing. So for computational intensive workload, like typical HPC work, it's almost perfect for Azure's pricing model, which is pay by the hour. So you would run for the amount of hours you're going to run, and then you just turn it off when you're not using it anymore. And the convenience of not having to manage and service and host one of these machines in a chilled data center is very compelling. So each of these units, when we first got them, I think they cost around $100,000 a piece. And this is not very cheap. But think about it, for you to be able to run very similar computation, you know, computing power, use the same amount of computing power, you can just pay $8 an hour on Azure. Essentially, I can have 8 nodes spinned up for 15. In 15 minutes, we have MPI running on that, which is the communication mechanism that are traditionally used by all these HPC applications. And then next, we can, once we're done, we can just turn everything off. And everything is right there on Azure that can be shared very easily by scientists and also developers of the code, or you know, even to make it more publicly aware, making them accessible to people who have, you know, don't even have access to them.
Yeah, so like a student or a professor at a small community college would have access to a supercomputer, essentially.
Exactly. So you would be able to have them anywhere in a classroom, or control it from your cell phone. In fact, I have simulations that I control from my phone Windows Phone 7.5 now.
And how many calculations per second does a machine like this do?
You know, that's a really good question. I didn't actually think about it. I didn't do any pre-computation, so I'm going to just throw some numbers at you.
All right.
My understanding is that each of these are I think copper tone. Those are a bit older. So I think they're probably around 10 gigaflops. Gigaflops meaning floating point operations per second.
Yeah.
You are essentially talking about, I would say, 60, maybe a bit more, maybe to 100 gigaflops.
Yeah.
That's, you know, a lot of floating point operations per second.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing that they have standards on what you can ship out of the country at that kind of speed, don't they?
Well, I think by now, at the rate of our compute technology, I think soon you will be to have that on your cell phone.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's export controlled for now, but
not much you can do at that point.
Not
yeah.
much you can do. In fact, I know that there are certain countries that are buying up PlayStation 2s like crazy,
yeah.
and using them for very sensitive type of calculations.
Tell us a little bit about the interface that you use to get these machines connected to each other.
Yep. So the connectors on these machines are not your ordinary Ethernet or 10 gig E. So for 10 gig E, gigabit Ethernet. Gigabit Ethernet are capable of doing, obviously, gigabit per second or 100 megabytes per second. So for these machines, they have InfiniBand, which is high bandwidth and low latency, which is very suitable for HPC or high performance computing. So the latency is in orders of, between 1.5 to 6 microseconds. So typical Ethernet, you're looking about 30 to 50, depending on what type of Ethernet hardware you actually have. And the other interesting thing about the bandwidth is that you're running at 20 gigabps on a switched network. So what that means is you can send a DVD in 2 seconds. So
nice.
My hard drive is not fast enough to actually be able to accept that.
Yeah.
The newer InfiniBand cards are capable of 100 gigabps, I think, at this point. So if you have several of them on one node, soon you would be able to transfer terabits per second if you want to.
So what type of developer tools would someone use to write code for this machine?
You can use anything that the open source community has, which is a majority of what HPC has been built on top of. So, for example, we have GCC that we actually host Windows version of GCC, or the MinGW 64-bit in this data center. We have 4 servers that are dedicated for their use. So I actually get to work with them a little bit and try to fix some of the issues that we had in terms of performance. So so those are the tools that you can use for migration. And we also offer a lot of interesting tools that offers you how to take your Linux code and look at the equivalent of Windows. So essentially, there are 3 major steps in running these type of HPC applications. The first step is build your application. So this is what I spend a lot of my energy on, because a lot of these applications run on Linux systems or Unix systems. So they've been around for hundreds of years by modern computer times.
Yeah.
In reality, they're really about 30 to 40 years. So we've been running these codes for a long time. So a lot of the times they don't necessarily work, or compile out of the box on Windows boxes. They don't quite work. But now we've gotten them work so well using cross compilers and other technologies, and working with PGI compilers and tools and build systems like CMake, folks from Kitware that we work very closely with. In that community, that we've gotten a lot of these codes working very well on Windows. So that's step number one. So building the tool, and the second part is running the tool. So the runtimes for traditional HPC applications has been MPI, or message passing libraries. What that does for you is it will do the low-level communication for you in a very extremely fast speed. So in fact, we are on Windows, we have RDMA hooked up to MPI, which means you bypass the kernel when you send a message. So you're not copying these messages in and out. So that reduced latency really helps with the performance in a tremendous way. So that's the runtime. And also, the third part is actually much more important to me, which is visualization. So we'll actually have some examples to show you. So when we run these HPC codes on these machines, it can run for hours and days, and you're just going to see numbers scrolling off your screen. And it's exciting for scientists. Yeah. Maybe not, but it's just exciting for, you know, researchers and scientists and developers of HPC code. But it's not very interesting to the general public. So they want to actually see the results. And even for researchers, they need to visualize their results, very large data sets. They need to visualize, you know, sometimes terabytes of data. And, you know, being able to look at that data on a large cluster is also something that's more challenging than you think. Because when you have a terabyte of data, how are you going to actually look at it on your workstation? You can't ship the data over.
Yeah.
So they have, we work very closely with a company of places like Livermore National Labs and Kitware. So we have parallel visualization tools that are working, you know, just the same on Windows clusters. So we have, you know, very interesting oil and gas exploration examples, and we have, you know, customers that, you know, really liked and enjoyed using tools that are open source. But on that, on top of that, we offer Visual Studios and other type of you know, tools that are only accessible on Windows. So it's really the best of both worlds is what I consider Windows HPC to be. And for the next version, actually for the current version, we can burst to Azure. Essentially, you can run transparently, do just simply a command line, do a job submit. Your job will be transparently running on Windows Azure. So that's essentially trying to make things really easy for developers and scientists is, you know, what the HPC product is, also my personal goal, you know, for making things better.
And how did you get into this yourself?
So the reason I got into HPC is because I walked into a wrong class many years ago. I think it was 1998 when I first I was a freshman at the University of Colorado. So I walked into this class called HPC, or High Performance Computing. I thought it would be a double E class, which is, you know, my major at the time, and which I later transferred to computer science. I looked at it going, well, you know, I was expecting a low-level, you know, transistor, you know, helping me understand how to design processors, perhaps. But turns out it was about scientific research. So I actually enjoyed that class more than anything else. So later on, I joined the physics department. I think after I took the class, I went to the physics department, where they developed very large-scale simulations for fusions and laser beams and that type of simulation. So I suddenly had access. I was a freshman in college, and suddenly I had access to all these supercomputers and national labs. And I can tell you the other funny thing is that the only 2 days that I actually stood up, you know, stayed up all night doing my homework was actually HPC. The reason is because the queues on the NCAR supercomputers, I was going to run it for about 10 minutes, but the queue is 6 hours long.
Yeah.
So this is actually perfect. And Azure will make it to the next stage where you don't even need this.
Yeah. And so what would you suggest to someone else who wants to get into supercomputers and high-performance computing? What types of tracks should they follow?
Well, 50% of world scientists are doing, you know, development, you know, related to HPCs. It's really everywhere. In fact, I go through a lot of talks about, you know, supercomputing. So we had several people from large companies who want to do R&D. They are finding that a lack of not only talent, but also a lack of, you know, good education on HPC. So a lot of the times, these scientists who would have to learn about, you know, they will have to learn HPCs themselves, because there aren't, you know, that many developers who are, you know, willing to go into HPC to help them, you know, be able to run their simulations. So they ended up being, you know, taking two roles. So this is one way of getting into it, which is the hard way, which is if you're a scientist already, you're, you know, in chemistry, you're in mechanical engineering. So that is something you're already doing. So that's one way of getting into HPC, which is, you know, start looking at this, you know, getting your programs to actually run on a cluster instead of just a single machine. So
yeah,
that's one way. And second thing is that for people who are, you know, computer science major, who are now, you know, all joining online companies instead of joining HPC. So there is definitely a talent drain in that. But on the other hand, it is very interesting, and this is kind of where, you know, distributed system came out of many years ago. So I think there is a tremendous amount of potential for that in R&D, as well as, you know, for people who want to do new things, making simulations that would people weren't able to do before. So I would inspire people to look at the kind of computation that are available to you today and see what you can do with the type of computational power that is available to an ordinary person by via cloud computing or a clusters that you have access to at your universities or other places.
So I want to see some of the apps that you're running on this, but we got to get out of here because I think I'm getting some frostbite. So
all right, I think you have those.
They're blowing right on me.
Yeah, blowing
so,
right on me.
So you want to go over the studio? We'll take a look at those.
Yeah.
All right, so now we're back in the studio. We're still wearing jackets, still trying to warm my core up after being in that room. But you're going to show us some demos here. What are the types of things that we're going to look at today?
Right, we have four demos today, and one of them is a image rendering that I produced. So essentially it's a 20,000 by 20,000 pixel frame of a tobacco mosaic virus that we rendered using my cluster. So that's one of the demo I want to show you. And I'm only going to open up Paint.
Okay.
And it will kind of show the type of details that you can get. So nowadays we have movies that are, you know, HD, but
yeah,
think about HD times 20 and 30, you know, much even higher resolution the studios have to actually produce to first for the animation. So right now I've seen a lot of 8,000 by 8,000 frames by large studios that they're producing. So this is actually, you know, one of the ways of using HPC, which is to do a rendering farm. Essentially, Pixar does a lot of that. And
uh-huh,
there's also many, many animation studios that are, you know, out there that uses, you know, either hire out their computation or use a cloud service like the Microsoft cloud service.
Very cool.
And the second one that I'd like to show you is the Northridge earthquake visualized. So
okay,
as we, you know, I mentioned previously to you, is that we want to, the three parts is build your application, run your application, and visualize. Visualization is extremely important. We have a program that's being developed here at Microsoft Research called Worldwide Telescope. So I actually took one of the HPC runs that we had and put that data set with the help of a very good friend of mine.
So you use that as part of the visualization tool.
And put that into a Worldwide Telescope and actually let you look at what's happening when the earthquake hit and why the LA earthquake, the Northridge earthquake, was such a damaging event.
Mm-hmm.
And I have another simulation that is a computational fluid dynamics card, dynamics code, and we're going to show you how a vehicle or, you know, a race car moves through the air and why you need to wear a helmet. And finally, we have a little, you know, quick demo showing you how to run a design optimization, essentially running hundreds and hundreds of jobs of varying the parameter a little bit, trying to find the optimal solution of a part using Azure right there from the HPC cluster.
Very cool. Let's take a look.
All right. So the first thing I want to show you is this tobacco mosaic virus. As you can see, on disk, it's actually not that large as a JPEG file. I think it was 23 megabytes. But when you uncompress it and into a bump file, it's somewhere between 1 and 1.5 gig.
I noticed it took a long time to open.
And I have a flash drive. I just got my new laptop.
Yeah, this is a top of the pretty line. Nice laptop.
Yeah, I got the Intel SSD in here, so otherwise it will take you even longer to be able to load this. So let's, if I look at this, it doesn't look all that impressive just, from afar. But what's interesting is that when we actually start making, zooming in to the actual pixel by pixel level.
Wow.
So now you can actually see the DNA or RNA strain that's inside. Actually, it's RNA. RNA strain that's inside this little tobacco mosaic virus. As you can see, there's a lot of details that you're looking at. So 20,000 by 20,000. So that's quite a few HDTVs stacked
yeah.
together would be to see the whole thing. So we're going to zoom out and just, give you a better perspective of what we were actually looking at. We were actually looking at this little region. So I wonder if we can actually just do a little zoom and just, see what kind of resolutions we can zoom into. So I'm at maybe, 50% zoom, and now it's probably 400. This is actually not zoomed in. It's more of a, this is the native pixel resolution of mm-hmm. This image. So I don't have an HD version to contrast with, but it will essentially look very pixely by the time
yeah.
you actually zoomed in. So this is the kind of details that you get when you do that on a cluster in about 6 hours.
Yeah, so the higher end HD that you would get at home on Comcast would be 1920 pixels by 1080. And
that's
this
right.
is 10 times that
yeah.
wide.
20,000 by 20,000.
20 times yeah. that tall.
Yeah.
Nice.
That's a lot of pixels that we have to render. But essentially for movie studios to make a movie, it will be... It's going to take you 24 frames per second, or maybe it's 30 frames per second sometimes,
mm-hmm.
30 times the number of seconds we have in 2 hours.
Yeah.
So that's 7,200. So that's a lot of computational power. So this is one reason you need to have a cluster. You're not going to try to have the movie done on your laptop. Definitely not on your laptop. But the other interesting thing is that I noticed is that these movies are getting larger and larger in size
yeah.
too. So it's really also the I/O that's
yeah.
Associated with it.
And then now that they're doing 3D, you can just double that.
That's right. You're even going to double that. And if you make a mistake, you have to re-render the whole thing.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's one of the demos that I have. And one of the final thing I want to say is that for you to run this application, you just simply run a command line. And with a data file that consists of the 3D structure of the this molecule, and it's about 50 megabytes as an input, but the output it goes out to about a gig.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's my first demo, and I have my second demo.
Second demo, Northridge.
Ah, that's right. I have to connect to my workstation on a CorpNet. So I have this little machine that I acquired 3 years ago. Let's see, I have to log in again. And this machine has been sitting on my desk for the past 3 years, and it was one of the fastest machines because it was a beta processor. You guys probably know a lot more about, have a lot of experience with beta hardware, but probably not so much experience with beta processors, and this one was actually a beta processor from Intel 3 years ago that I ran, and it runs at 6 cores, and you can buy them now easily. But 3 years ago, it was top of the line. It was really, really cool to have one of these. So this is the simulation that I want to run. So the Worldwide Telescope Program is code is developed by one of our geniuses at the MSR. His name is Jonathan Fay. He's one of our principal researcher over there, or maybe developer. He did this all by himself. So you will be able to fly through the space, be able to visualize the you know, all the planets. It's one of the most popular software that's out there with, you know, schools and other places. So what we're seeing here is a simulation of the Northridge earthquake. As you can see that this kind of started around the Moore Park area, the San Fernando area, and then it kind of, you know, concentrated that energy and really hit the LA, kind of really moved that energy and targeted that energy through the downtown area. And this is why it did a lot of damage. You can see it's right there. Mm-hmm. And we're kind of just switching angles to show you how it works as a, you know, 3D simulation. We also have a 2D version, which I can show you. It's called seismic.cloudapp.net. which you can actually play with yourself. Once this is done, we're going to show that to you a little bit. So as you can see that, there's a little flickering because we were connected to the corp net here. See, so I have the second version, which is which is the actually 2D version, which is sitting in a cloud. So the data sets that we have here are all sitting in a SQL Azure database. So if I run the simulation, it's pulling the rastered images from the storage space on that we have all these different data points, and overlaying it on top of Bing. So these little monitors, you can actually click on them and see what actually happened at that area, with the little seismic.
So it's seismic sensors that were around the town at the time?
That's right. And then you can actually click on the depth and look at, what's going on at the various, depths of this. So the point of this demo is really showing you the power of the cloud, which is you'll be able to share this information even after you have finished running your code. So keeping the data on the cloud is really convenient to show, this is a simulation that you did, and this is something that, you can share with your colleague. And one of the things that a lot of people are pushing right now is called reproducible science. Mm-hmm. So having that data right there, having other people be able to, share and look at the magnitude of the earthquake and looking at what's actually happening there is extremely powerful way to share.
Yeah, and it seems like it'd be a good way for different schools and universities and scientists to collaborate, because that's a lot of data, and to move that between them alone would be time-consuming.
Right. And I did the simulation right there on Azure, and then I don't have to rerun the simulation. I just store the data, and I can share it. If I want to rerun the simulation, I don't have that working right now, but you can probably set up a little portal, and then you can go in. And this is what our HPC product is moving in the next direction, in the direction next, which is using a portal system to be able to allow you to run everything right there and visualize your results.
Very
cool.
And be
able to share.
Nice.
Okay, so this is the second demo, and the third demo I'm going to, and the third and fourth are all both related to a program, an open source program called OpenFOAM, which is essentially a computational fluid dynamics code. Well, so what it does is it uses a numerical solver to simulate a physical system. The physical system could be a car moving through the air and trying to figure out the lift and the drag on the vehicle as it's moving through the air. And you can also try to figure out interesting things like how to design a better vacuum cleaner. So we have two demos on that today. So let me connect you to that. So here I am going to show you for the very first time what our cluster actually looks like. So you saw on the video when we were in the data center what it looked like. And here's the actual management console. As you can see, it's very, very familiar to folks that uses Windows Server. So we have, job management. As you can see, those are the things that I've, finished running. I've run in the past. As you can see, I run a lot of little jobs for testing. And also active, there's currently nothing running. And if we go to the node management, you can see that all these nodes are kind of sitting idle. So let's light them up.
Let's do it. Yeah,
exactly. So you can see I have some Azure nodes, which are, you can simply right-click and say, I want to add some Azure nodes. Add nodes, and you can say, okay, I want to add some Azure nodes. That's probably the easiest way you would be able to allow you to run, you know, suddenly spin up a bunch of Azure nodes and run stuff on them, right? There's actually no .NET programming required. You're just simply submitting a job and running it.
And you have kind of a mixture here of Cray nodes and Azure nodes.
And this is, you know, Azure nodes that I added, and also these are on the on-premise nodes that you saw in the data center. So I have 8 blades per machine. So each of them have 8 cores, so you end up having 128 gigabytes of RAM, which is quite a bit.
Not too bad.
64 cores running the simulation. So let's actually take a look at the simulation and see what it does. First of all, I do want to, you know, bring credit to one of our wonderful collaborators at Simscape. So Dr. Richard Smith has, you know, developed this program. And I think it was a year and a half ago where I met him on one of the forums on CFD Online, I believe. Where we, you know, talked a little bit about the idea of having these very complicated program more accessible to everyone, not just scientists, just, you know, to everybody. So the idea is that we looked at, you know, I convinced him that, you know, look, Windows is 90% of all the computers that's out there these days, of workstations and laptops. We have a tremendous amount of user base that's out there that, you know, his program could target. So this was essentially ported over, and we also got help from my longtime collaborators, you know, from the open source community, like the GNU C++, which actually cross-compiled this code, and the performance has been fairly good after the cross-compilation. So now it's up to about, you know, within the same range of any other platform. So so the idea is that you suddenly have a lot more people would be able to run this. So this program allows you to run CFD on client, which is shared memory, because we all have lots of cores now, and then run it on a cluster, and then running it on Azure, and we even have a GPU version, which we're going to release very soon, we'll just say in the next week or so, that allows you to use the power of your GPU to be able to do the computation. And you know, that's for another episode.
Yeah.
Talk about, you know, all the things that you can do with a GPU these days, which could be, you know, thousands of times faster than a conventional CPU by now.
Yeah.
For a lot of code. So talking about massive parallelism. So okay, let's get back to this. So the first thing I want to do is to show you. If we go to File and go to Preferences, so this is what I was, you know, talking about, which is, you know, the being able to pick between shared memory, cluster, cloud, and cloud burst. So I want to kind of explain what cloud burst means. Cloud burst is essentially using our HPC cluster to run your application on Azure. You would absolutely have to write no .NET program. You're just simply doing a job submit, and everything's just magically happening for you. So that is my idea, or, you know, the goals that I've always had for scientific programs, which is to be able to run your code transparently on client, cluster, and the cloud. And, you know, now actually we have a GPU version too. The user should not have to know specifically what is that you're running it on. Just push a button, and it should do the work for you.
Yeah.
This is what all the ISVs should model their application after, which is just be so much more, you know, so much easier for users, rather than having to log on to different machines, do the work there, remembering what the file structure is, have to compile it there, having to do all this extra work just to run your program. So that's the computer scientist of you, a part that you should not have to worry about. Okay, so let's actually take a look at the cluster. So I did pick the cluster, and if I pick the cluster, I can, you know, have up to 56 cores, because I do want one of the nodes to be free. So I'm simply going to press run. And One of the things I want to show you on this vehicle is that I can actually move it around a little bit, so you can see how the air is moving around the vehicle as it's moving through the air. So as you can see that there's a little speed indicator or
so what we're looking at here is how fast the air is moving across the car, and
right.
It's a heat map of that. And
it's
so ideally, we want to see as little red as possible if we're doing a good fast design.
You want the lift and drag to be minimized.
Yeah.
So essentially, you want, as you're moving through the air, you want the car to be pushed down to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want it to be lifting your car, actually.
Yeah.
Right? If it would just fly through.
Yeah,
you've actually seen some
plane.
Of that.
Yeah, that's a plane. Called a plane.
You've actually seen some of those happening when the cars actually break up. They will just fly.
Yeah.
You know, they'll just, flip over.
Yeah. See it a lot with boats, too. They'll hit a wave, and then they catch air.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Next thing you know, they're a plane.
So those are the kind of things that people want to find out before they actually go build the boat.
Yeah.
Right? So in here, we're actually running running the solution here on the cluster. The nice thing about this simulation is that you can vary your parameter and you can run it multiple times if you wanted to. So essentially what's really happening underneath, it's running a finite volume solve. The solver, as you can see, is running a volume solve. So the volume solver is distributed over to the cluster. So it's actually distributed over to the cluster. As you can see, I'm using 56 cores, or 7 of the nodes that's on the cluster. So since I have InfiniBand, it's being able to communicate extremely efficiently for that numerical solver. So in general, they're running these iterative solvers that are extremely computational intensive. So as you can see, it kind of has to write a little step every time it finishes a little bit. Then, all the CPUs cools down, has to synchronize, and then it brings it up again. And so this is a very traditional, I would just say, very traditional HPC code, and it's essential to the industry nowadays. So since my cluster is completely full on-premise, so I do want to start using some of the nodes on Azure. So how would you do that? I would do exactly the same thing, which is... here's another machine that I have, another one of the nodes on the cluster. So I'm going to go ahead and run this little vacuum cleaner-like model. As you can see, what it's really happening is that you can have the intake air that comes in, and when it goes to the bottom, it slows down to almost nothing, and then it has a little compression, and then it shoots at a very high speed out. As you can see, it's extremely high speed there. The highest speed. So that's how a vacuum cleaner works. But if you want to find the best design, in terms of how the, shape works, we might want to run multiple of them. So if I just, do a run here, and it's going to say uploading to start, as you can see, I actually absolutely did nothing. I wouldn't have to leave this program. And if I in fact, let me actually show you by opening another little instance of this. If I go to Program and go to Preferences and go back to the Physics, and don't worry, I'm going to zoom in and make sure that you guys can actually see it. So go to Cloudburst. As you can see, I just simply clicked on Cloudburst, and the information I have to enter in is no more than a login and a password, which is your Azure storage account. This is my blob storage username and account. And this is actually not difficult to implement either. So you're simply doing a copy of the case file onto Azure blob storage, and then you're launching the job right there on one of the Azure nodes. So Azure is just simply Windows.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's no different from when we are running that on local nodes. So there's an extra step, which is you have to upload the file. Other than that, I think we have a very transparent system here. So what I want to do, instead of just running one of them, as you can see, I'm just running one, and let's actually find out how it is running that. So if you go to the Job Scheduler Manager and go to Activity, you can see it actually is still running. It started on one of the Azure nodes. And let's go to that node. You can see it's using one core out of the four cores that I allocated for that particular node. So I could run lots of these instead of just one. So I wrote a little batch script, which is the simplest batch script you can ever imagine. So DOS is back in style. So all I had to do is to run 20 times. I'm just going to run this little bat file. The bat file is just going to call this application. As you can see, this is nothing complicated at all. I'm just going to say run this, run the executable, which submits a job. It just does a job submit. I'm going to run that, and it's going to saturate my machine because it's going to suddenly allocate lots of memory and do all kinds of crazy stuff. So we're going to switch off to back to my other run. Hopefully it finished by now. There you go. So it's actually still going. But what we showed you earlier is actually the result. It's like the cooking show where you are actually showing you the results first. As you can see that I'm still waiting for those other jobs to be submitted. Like I did the 20 design optimization, which is very similar, but by varying the parameter a little bit. But I'm submitting that to the job scheduler. So as you can see, it's still preparing. It's loading up. It has to read in the data, upload them onto Azure, so it takes a little bit of time, and then run the simulation. So as you can see, they're starting to get queued up and starting to run. So you can see that my Azure nodes are going to start get busy again, while the on-premise one is still running. As you can see, this is the on-premise one, which is using 56 cores. That's a lot of cores.
Not too bad.
And you can look at the activity. We actually do a lot of that automatically for you. So we'll say, okay, we're going to allocate these resources. A lot of PhDs spend a lot of time figuring out how to optimize that resource allocation algorithm.
Yeah.
Okay, so as you can see, they're really starting to run the 20 jobs that I submitted on another node. So sooner or later, you're going to see these nodes start to light up a little bit. But as we speak, so they're starting to light up. As you can see that we submitted 20 of them. So we have a total of eight Azure cores, maybe 10 actually. It's 10. I can't count today. So there's 10 of them. So we do have some access. So you're going to see about half of the workload. You can see about 50% of the load running on Azure. So as you can see, I can very transparently run my code on just local cluster in the cloud. And for people who don't have a cluster, the simplest configuration is just one head node, which is you have one machine. And then you can add the cloud nodes as you need to. And for those of you who prefer not to have anything to do with a machine, so I actually do know people have absolutely no computers. We have new versions coming up, which you can simply go to a portal and submit your jobs as a in a REST interface or through a web browser. Just say browse to my input file and submit a job, and you can do it that way. So absolutely zero initial cost for you. So this
Very
is my
nice.
0-1 infinity rule, which is zero stands for no initial cost. One is 100% utilization. You don't want to pay for stuff. You don't want to do idle computing. You don't want to pay 12 cents a core per hour for idle computing, right? So this is actually the best business fit for Azure, which is pay by the hour to do computational intensive work. You're using all of it, and then you shut it down, and you don't have to pay for it again. There's no data center to run, and there's no cooling system, which you were blown on for about 15 minutes. So that's pretty much my story here.
Very cool. Well, thanks for showing us this, Wenming. I love this.
Well, thank you, Larry.
And we'll sync with you again and talk about GPU.
Absolutely. We got some really serious hardware sitting in my office, and we have so about 20 state-of-the-art GPUs sitting in that's coming into the data center, and we're going to show you how to run millions of cores.
Nice. Can't wait to see it.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.